we're talking about our gendered world and what it means to be born the wrong gender, especially in the eyes of the church. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for being here. One profound truth that Pastor Paula Stone Williams has reckoned with is this one. Gender identity is at the core of one's being. To deny it is to deny yourself permission to be you. And being transgender, she writes, is not a crime, but she lost thousands of friends, her career stature as a CEO when she transitioned. Join in any point in the conversation, 800-642-1234, your thoughts on gender identity. Paula Stone Williams is a pastor and pastoral counselor in Colorado. She speaks on gender equity, LGBTQ advocacy, religious tolerance. Her new memoir is called As a Woman, What I Learned About Power, Sex, and the Patriarchy After I Transitioned. Paula, welcome to the Ideas Network.
It's so good to be with you this morning.
I want to first thank you for letting us into your life. And you've said before you don't see yourself as a trailblazer, but your life, it contains countless teachable moments that, you know, we can explore. But how are you now? How are you doing emotionally with your life story and your transition fully on display in your memoir?
You know, I was fairly well known in the evangelical world, so I knew I couldn't just slip into the night. I knew that embedded in my identity were responsibilities. And so I knew that I was going to have to be a public figure. Besides, I was a part of the evangelical world for a very long time, a world that is not LGBTQ plus affirming. And so I thought, you know, I got a lot I need to make up for. I need to live a long time because I need to get the message out.
Yeah. And so you've done TED Talks. You've really been vocal about what you've learned about yourself and how you see the world, and also about living in two worlds and the fact that life is easier for men. What did you learn about privilege as you transitioned?
I don't think I had a clue just how privileged I was. And I think that's the case for most well-educated white men in America. We just have no idea how easy life is for us, that we start closer to the finish line than anyone else. And it did not take me long as a woman to realize, oh my goodness, I do not have the same privilege I had before. It started the very first day I ever flew as a woman. That was the one area that I could compare easily with my life as a man, because I was still flying, same airplane, the same airlines, the same experience that I had before, but now the experience was in fact quite different.
Yeah. And who has access to that seat? I mean, you had this dispute with another passenger, like, no, that's my seat. And the passenger just like wrote you off. What happened there?
You know, it was the very first time I ever flew as a woman. I was flying from Denver to Charlotte, and I got on the plane and there was stuff in my seat. And so I picked the stuff up and put my stuff down. And the guy said, that's my stuff. I said, okay. But it's in my seat. So I'll be glad to hold it for you till you find your seat. He said, lady, that is my seat. I said, yeah, actually, it's not. It's my seat, 1D. But like I said, I'd be happy to hold your stuff till you find your seat. He said, I don't know what I need to tell you. That is my seat. I said, yeah, actually, it's not. It's my seat. At which point the guy behind me said, lady, would you take your blank argument elsewhere so I can get in the airplane? I was stunned. I had never been treated like that as a man. I could tell you exactly what would have happened. I would have said, excuse me, I believe that's my seat. And immediately the guy would have looked at his boarding pass and said, oh, I'm sorry. I know, because it happened scores of times. You know, finally the flight attendant takes our boarding passes, says to the guy, sir, you're in 1C, she's in 1D. I put his stuff down in 1C. He doesn't say a word. End up sitting next to the guy who said, would you take your blanking argument elsewhere? And my friend who worked for American came onto the plane to give the paperwork to the captain. And when she left, she waved goodbye. And I got to Charlotte, she called me. She said, Paula, what happened? You were as white as a sheet. And I told her, and she said, oh yeah, welcome to the world of women. You know, it's just, and it's been that way ever since. I still fly over 100,000 miles a year, and it doesn't get any better. So it was a rude awakening for me. I just had no idea. I don't think there's any way a well-educated man can understand how much the world's tilted in his favor. And conversely, I don't think there's any way a woman can understand the full import of that. I mean, I think she knows intuitively. She's working twice as hard for three quarters as much, but I don't think she really has any idea just how much more difficult life is for her than that is for the guy in the Brooks Brothers jacket in the office across the hall. I know I was that guy.
We're talking with Paula Stone Williams. The new book is called As a Woman, and you can join in. Do you have people who have transitioned in your life, relatives, friends, colleagues? How has your circle or workplace shown support toward them? Join in 800-642-1234. I want to back up, Paula, way, way back. You knew from a very, very young age that you were in the wrong body from the start. What are some of those early memories you have that being a boy wasn't right for you?
I was probably about 3 or 4 years of age, and I thought I got to choose. I mean, I knew that I was a girl, and I think about it now, that actually was male privilege. But I thought, well, I get to choose. And somewhere before kindergarten, a gender fairy will show up and will say, okay, what's it going to be? Is it going to be a boy or a girl? And of course, I would choose what I knew myself to be. I would choose girl. And then, by the time kindergarten started, it's like, oh, actually, I don't get to choose my gender. This has been chosen for me. I was a part of a fundamentalist family. My father was a pastor. I knew there was no way I could talk about it. Besides, nobody knew anything back then. This was the 1950s. And so I just lived my life. I didn't hate being a boy. I think every transgender person's experience is their own experience, so you can't speak for anyone else. I know a lot of trans people who feel like they were a girl trapped in a boy's body. I didn't feel that way. I felt like I was a boy trapped in a boy's body, that I was not supposed to have been born a boy, that I was supposed to have been born a girl. But I didn't hate it. It didn't really become a problem for me until puberty. And then my body started changing in ways I absolutely despised. Well, my friends who were girls had bodies changing in ways that I desperately wanted mine to be changing. And those were the really toughest years, junior high. Of course, they're tough for everybody. I mean, who's enjoys their junior high years, but they were especially hard for me.
You had a very tenuous, a rocky relationship with your mother. You write about how it wasn't always safe. When you stood up to her later in life, she told you to leave and never come back. Your relationship with your father, very nurturing. What did you learn about yourself through the eyes of your parents, in Kentucky?
I think I was fortunate to have a father who was, in fact, so gentle and generous and loving until my mother demanded that he behave otherwise. And then he acquiesced and did whatever she requested. But it's hard to grow up the child of a narcissistic parent. That keeps all of us in therapy for a good long while. Because that parent has been wounded extremely early in life and never really accepts any responsibility for themselves. So the problem is never internal, it's always external. The problem was never anything she had done, it was always me. So add to that someone who is very, very fundamentalist religiously, and then add to that being a transgender child and recognizing that that was simply not something that could ever be discussed. I used to harbor these thoughts that I could tell my father, but I think by the time I was in high school, I knew that that actually wasn't something that was possible either. And in fact, did not tell them until shortly before I transitioned.
Something that I find difficult is I wasn't next to either of my parents when they passed away, and you weren't either. Was it hard not having a proper goodbye, or do you feel like there was a goodbye as Paula with your dad?
No, there wasn't. There was no closure. My father died during COVID. My mother died shortly before it. We didn't expect her death to take place that particular day. So I was in Colorado. She was in Kentucky. Both of those were quite difficult for me. It's you need closure. You need to be able to say goodbye. And I didn't really have that opportunity with either one. In my father's case, we weren't even able to have a funeral. And he was very beloved. in the small town in eastern Kentucky where he last ministered before he retired. And we were hoping to do something a little bit later, but now it's a full year later and still not possible to do something publicly there. So yeah, that was difficult. It also made me realize how difficult it was for my family to not be able to say goodbye to Paul. I have a chapter in the book, Dying Before Dying, and I think it's one of the hardest things about transitioning is if you're a person who's done a lot of interior work, you think you're the same person post-transition, and the truth is, you're not. My son was the first to say that to me, and he would say it very angrily and strongly. I would say, Jonathan, I'm still the same person. And he'd say, No, you are not. You are fundamentally changed. And I realize now that that is, in fact, the case, that I am not the same person I was before. And I don't think we did a good job in honoring or in memorializing the time that our whole family had with Paul, me included. I think we needed to have said goodbye in a formal way. And it's not something we ever did. I think we all kind of feel like it's a little bit too late to do that now. But that's something I do regret in the transition process.
Reverend Paula Stone Williams with us, describing her journey as a transgender woman, the social, the spiritual. Do you have relatives, friends, or colleagues who have transitioned? How have the people around them showed support? Are you a member of the LGBTQ plus community? How did you come out to your family? What was their response like? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about a transition journey and what it means for a transgender woman who was raised in a deeply devoted evangelical family. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Paula Stone Williams writes, she was not prepared to leave the ministry she had led for a quarter of a century, served for 35 years, but she lost her jobs, her stature in the Christian community. She lost thousands of friends when she called to transition genders. Have you been called? What can you share about your transition? How do you grieve a life that is over but still lives in a new form? 800-642-1234. The new memoir is called As a Woman, and Paula Stone Williams is with us for the hour. Paula, let's talk about faith and about religion. You come from a very strong evangelical background. You were slated to go to Bible college. You know, you and your brother to become pastors, really no other career options. How did that tract shape your upbringing and where you were headed?
Oh, it shaped it massively. When I was in high school, I was fortunate enough to get a job as a disc jockey at a commercial radio station because doesn't every 16-year-old get a job as a disc jockey at a commercial radio station? You know, I just think of all of that male privilege that I had. There were no girl DJs back then. And I really wanted to continue in broadcasting and had a scholarship offer at a university in Kentucky for broadcasting, but in my family, it had been determined long before I was born that I would attend Kentucky Christian University and I would go into the ministry. It's just what the family business was. And so I went into ministry and was always probably the kind of person who had plenty of doubts that I brought along with me. I said in my second TED talk that I believe in God on pretty much every day of the week, except for Tuesdays and Thursdays and any day you're on the New Jersey Turnpike, because my God, it's the New Jersey Turnpike. But I've always had a kind of a little bit of a difficulty with evangelical thought processes because I've always felt like certainty was a myth. And to feel that certainty is a myth in the evangelical world is to take your life into your own hands. Your life is functionally in peril. And so for me, that was never a great fit, but I rose very quickly in the ranks of ministry in that world and became quite successful in it and thought, well, I can change it from the inside. So I particularly was focused in the area of establishing new churches from scratch. Our organization was New York City based. We became one of the largest in the nation at what we did. We started new churches that grew from nothing to 500 in average attendance by year five, over 1,000 by year 10. And we started churches that were, in fact, not LGBTQ plus affirming. And I look back on that now. I wanted to do that from the 1980s. My own theology would have agreed with that. But I thought, well, it's just not time yet. And I realize now that was a cop-out. It was just a way for me to remain comfortable. It's the kind of typical thing that a powerful white male does, is think, well, I can bring about change from within. And the whole time, what really is going on is somewhere beneath the surface, he's also thinking, without losing any of my power or privilege.
Well, a little more on the economics there, because you make the point that, you know, in church planting, conservative donors would pull support if you showed support for LGBTQ advocacy. What were the dynamics there of money and support?
You know, of course, so much is driven by finance when the day is done. I had made a decision early on in the organization when I was CEO to move a little bit to the left. And when I did that, I was shocked because we lost 30% of our general fund support. And I did not move back. I didn't recoil from that decision. But at the same time, it also was informative to me that I would be putting the ministry in jeopardy if I were to take bigger steps. And of course, within the evangelical world, the two big steps you cannot take and remain in evangelicalism are a woman's right to choose and LGBTQ affirmation. Those are the two social issues that have been chosen by the evangelical world, and also, interestingly, by the Roman Catholic world, to be the social issues on which they focus. I also find it kind of fascinating that both of those worlds are purely male-driven, and they have chosen two subjects on which to focus that cost their male leadership absolutely nothing. No male pastoral leader has to have an abortion or think about it, and only 3% of them are LGBTQ+. And so those are positions it's easy for them to hold without having to give up anything. On the other hand, if they made their major social positions, oh, let's say systemic racism or socioeconomic inequality, well, now they're actually going to have to give up something. So I don't know. I'm a little bit suspicious about the two subjects they've chosen.
We're talking with Paula Stone Williams, who's a pastor, pastoral counselor in Colorado, as we talk about her new memoir. Paul is joining us from Washburn with a question. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
Hi, we can hear you. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So, Paula, first I want to say, kudos to you for your bravery. I know it couldn't have been easy to do that. I definitely harbor, as I hear in your voice, I too harbor some, for lack of a better word, anger probably at this point with the evangelical conservative community. And I wanted to just say that right off the bat. But the question I have for you is this. I attended a seminar probably a year and a half ago for people who were studying to become occupational therapy assistants. And obviously a very sensitive group to your particular lifestyle and the challenges that go around this. And I raised the question at the time. I said, you know, we've got this long acronym now, and transgender, for me at that time, I'm a 58-year-old man, was the most confusing of all. And I raised the question in the seminar, and the speaker seemed to understand it. And my question was, are we really doing a service to people who are transgender by lumping them under this umbrella of letters that not all of us really understand?
And, yeah.
And when I asked that, there was some pushback. Like, people thought, well, you must just not be comfortable with transgender. And I thought, no, it's actually the opposite. I think that they're living a life that's different than a person who chooses to be a lesbian, if I'm using the correct terms, and I think this is what we get into, or is gay. I have an older sister who is a lesbian. I always thought she was gay. And those are the questions that I think we have, and I wanted to see, without going down that road, just your thoughts on if you feel you're represented well as far as understanding goes and advocacy goes for your particular, again, another question, do I call it lifestyle, or it isn't a lifestyle, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. Paula, go ahead.
It's not a lifestyle. It is, in fact, a part of your identity. Your gender identity and your sexual identity, in fact, are two different things. Your gender identity is who you want to go to bed as. Your sexual identity is who you want to go to bed with. And I actually believe the transgender community has been helped by being put together with the LGB community because we're only 0.58% of the population. So we really would not have a lot of power in the culture at large were it not for having been adopted, if you will, by the LGB community. Although it's rather interesting because some groups within that community have probably been no better with us than the population at large. Gay white males, for instance, I find don't really know any more about us than anybody else.
Paula Stone Williams speaks on gender equity, LGBTQ plus rights, inclusive religion. Her TED Talks have been viewed many millions of times. You can join in. Do you know someone who is part of the LGBTQ plus community? 800-642-1234. The memoir is called As a Woman. We'll pick this up after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're talking about a gendered world and how Paula Stone Williams' vantage point is unique. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Paula writes, "My female life has been a sober awakening. I want to validate the experiences of women and help men understand how much the world is tilted in their favor." What does gender equity mean to you? Have you experienced the differences between living as a man and living as a woman? What have you discovered? Join in any point, 800-642-1234. Paula's new memoir is called As a Woman, and she's with us for the hour. Paula, I want to do a little more exploration with your family. And when you met Kathy, you were so young, so in love, married at such a young age. And Kathy, you found that simpatico. You found your rock. You know, from a frugal family like yourself, deeply rooted in evangelical Christianity. And then, you know, you write about waking up on that first morning together of your honeymoon in that roadside Holiday Inn feeling dread. What were you experiencing there?
I think for me, it was the end of a dream. I think I had somehow fashioned in my own mind this dream that being intimate with my spouse was going to take away my gender dysphoria. I was a fundamentalist child. We did not have sex before marriage. And I discovered that night that much as I enjoyed the relationship that I had with Kathy, it did not take away my gender dysphoria. So it was early the next morning. It was before dawn. I was lying in bed looking up at the concrete ceiling and thinking, oh my God, I'm in the wrong body. It was a sobering, terrifying moment. I was just 21. She was 19. We were much, much too young to be getting married. But it was so frightening that I did what most of us do when we're confronted by something that's that frightening. I buried it. Denial is a very good thing. Denial actually is functional for us when it stops us from having to confront issues we're not yet ready to deal with in our lives. And I certainly was in denial at that point with the reality of my gender dysphoria.
When did you tell Kathy? How did she find out?
Yeah, oh God, I wish I could say I told her months before we got married. That's not true. I told her months after we got married because I realized that marriage had not cured me. Naive as that sounds, that's what I expected or certainly hoped, and realized then that I needed to talk with her about it. But again, this was 1973. Nobody really knew anything. There were no books in the library. There were no stories on television. And so no one even knew what to call it. Occasionally, you would hear someone talk about transsexuality. But even then, that was not a term that was commonly in use. And so I told her what I understood to be true at the time. And we both were so naive and really so committed to each other as well that we thought, well, we'll just be able to deal with this together. And Kathy, in fact, was amazing and continues to be amazing in dealing with it. We're both psychotherapists and we still practice together, even though we're divorced. We're still close. it was my birthday last month, and so it was one of the big birthdays, and so our whole family went to Hawaii together, and she went with us, and we grandparent together, but it really was not at all fair to her.
You know, as you went through the therapy together and worked through this, Kathy had at times called it your problem. And I'm wondering how that would sit with you.
Well, it doesn't do much for one's self-esteem. But the truth is, if you live in an evangelical world and you've been raised as an evangelical, it's pretty common for those folks to think badly about themselves, to look at their sin, if you will. And so for me, this was it was not a problem to say this was my problem, because it was in fact a problem to the marriage, and it was a problem that existed because I was transgender. But I look back on it now, and it certainly didn't help either one of us deal with it in any kind of an objective way.
You found peace in the years raising your three kids, and you had said, you know, there's no way that you would have transitioned when they were still at home. What was it like in raising the kids?
You know, I don't even know how to explain it, because I was really very comfortable being their father. Mm. And I still had the longing. I mean, every single day you would have the longing. But I really liked being a father. And so the years they were home, I just loved those years. And I still like playing that role of father, or living that role of father with them. And it's something that to a degree I still am able to do with them. Jonathan still calls me dad, and it's comfortable to both of us. He lives in Brooklyn. And we were going to a restaurant one night, and one of the girls had taken her bike with her, and the bike started to roll into the street. And Jonathan said, "Dad, Dad, Dad." And so I ran to get it and got the bike, and people were looking around like, "Wait, what? I picked what?" The girls don't call me dad, though. The girls call me Paula.
I was going to ask you that, and how the grandkids see you and as their grandparent. What do they call you?
They call me Graham Paula. Jonathan's girls came up with that. G-R-A-M-P-A-U-L-A. And all five of them took to it quickly, although it was Jonathan's two girls that first used that language. Trista, JL's daughter, had already given me a name, Paula Blossom.
Blossom. Yeah, I love
which,
that.
Oh my God, it is so precious. But it was Graham Paula that stuck, and I'm very comfortable with that.
Let's take another.
It was nothing to the grandkids. It was nothing to the grandkids when I transitioned. It's so easy for children to deal with this. I mean, it was 5 minutes, and then they were ready for life to go on.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think we know that children below six are able to deal with that without much emotional trauma. But I think it's also generational. I find that there's hardly anybody under 30 years of age that even thinks twice about the fact that I'm trans. It's incidental to the other parts of my life, which is how I love it. I love it when it can just be incidental.
Hmm. Let's bring in Sandy now in Southeast Wisconsin. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What is on your mind?
Well, I'm just concerned about some of the things that are happening in you know, teachings in school these days, which I am just becoming aware of. I think my daughter really hasn't, you know, told me too much. She's in middle school. And, you know, yesterday was, you know, the first day of June, and it was Pride Month. And so they were handing out flags and buttons, you know, for gay pride, all these different trans, pan, all these different sexual identities, which it seems like they're promoting it so much in school. And I mean, it's fine to have the awareness. And, you know, our family is not homophobic. We have some friends that are gay. But why are they in school promoting it so much that kids that are still finding themselves and just trying to figure out themselves, not just sexually, but other ways in middle school, that they're getting more confused. And so, like, for instance, like, Like one girl said, she's like, well, I'm not really that attracted to boys, so maybe I'm a lesbian. And if my daughter would say anything like against any of this, then right away her friends think she's homophobic, and well, she's not.
Sandy, thank you. Let's bring in Paula. What are your thoughts on talking in school and the education?
I understand a mother's concern on that issue, particularly as it relates to her own child, because during those teen years, children are beginning to differentiate from mom and dad. And so they're looking for ways in which they can separate from home. And we do see an increase in the number of children who are identifying as either transgender or gender non-binary. And we don't really know exactly what that is. Are they truly transgender? Are they truly non-binary? Or is this rather typical differentiation? And this happens to be something that is just in the headlines right now. But here's the truth. Transgender children whose parents are not supportive have a 13 times higher rate of suicide than their peers. And so I think what we see in Pride Month is extremely important for those adolescents. When we take a look right now at the fact that there are over 100 bills pending in over 30 states, 9 now that have been passed, taking away the civil rights of transgender children, these adolescents shouldn't have to be dealing with being the target of conservatives, and particularly evangelical conservatives, because that's who's driving these laws. And so I think it's wonderful that children who are, in fact, trans or gay or non-binary are in a supportive environment in the public schools now where they are able to explore their identity. And I think parents have nothing to fear because that's exactly what's happening. They're exploring their identity. And if we allow them the freedom to do that, they will in fact pretty quickly figure out exactly who they are. And if we can provide that opportunity in a supportive environment, all the kids who are cis and straight will be just fine. But those who have not been fine to this point, the trans and the gay and the non-binary kids, those kids are going to have a much more supportive environment. And they are so at risk that I think it's critically important that we provide them with that supportive environment, particularly in these polarizing times where gender dysphoria, being transgender, has become such a political lightning rod.
Pastoral Counselor Paula Stone Williams, as we talk about her journey of transition and how to find closure of the person she was, even though she doesn't regret the decision to transition. Are you confronting gender identity? What types of conversations have you had with your kids? Join in. Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Paula Stone Williams here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Paula Stone Williams, she writes in her memoir that she cannot speak for other transgender individuals, but she wishes there had been another pathway for her. But the call toward authenticity is sacred and holy and for the greater good. She writes, if you are wise, you trust life's flow. Her book is called As a Woman, and Paula is with us for 10 more minutes. I want to talk more about physical changes and just what happened to you when you went on hormones. I'm going to call you super tall and also a big runner, but I was really fascinated that even with your running, you slowed down. What were some of those changes you recognized in your body?
So testosterone is an incredibly powerful substance, as is estrogen. And so the loss of testosterone and the addition of estrogen bring about massive changes in your body. And one of those is that you, in fact, lose muscle mass. And so I'm both a mountain biker, and I live in the Rocky Mountains here in Colorado, and I'm a runner. And I've always been competitive primarily with myself. And I just began to notice my times dropping really what felt to me like precipitously. It's like, oh, I did not think that I would lose that much power. But in fact, you do. There are massive changes to your body. Fat migrates to places that you don't necessarily want the fat to migrate. You lose muscle mass. Your skin becomes thinner. This is why you find women have sweaters in the office when men don't. And it's also because offices always have their temperature at 58 degrees. That's because men get to set the temperature in offices, but that's a whole different story. But I really discovered so many changes in my body. And it is, in fact, not something I fully anticipated. I was just thinking about it this morning. I started hormones 9 years ago yesterday. And it's been a long time since I've had testosterone functioning in my body.
You also went through surgery. What did you do with your face, or how did that impact in your transition?
You know, one of the things that I find fascinating is that according to many studies, humans are pre-wired to see a face as male unless there are very clear markers that it's not male. And so if you, in fact, are a person of significant financial means, which I was, then often the first surgery that is done is facial feminization surgery. In my case, I was really fortunate that when I went to the surgeon, he did all the measurements all over my face,
yeah.
and said, your eyes are within normal female parameters. In fact, 100% female parameters. Your cheeks are 100% female parameters. Your chin's a little bit male, but that's not a good surgery. You don't need a brow shave because the brows of men protrude more than the brows of women. Yours doesn't. So the only thing we really need to do is your nose, which already needed work done, and a tracheal shave. So those are the only two things I had to do. But they actually made a really significant difference. And that, when we're able to, is often the first surgery we do, because that makes the biggest difference in whether or not the world sees you as a woman. It's interesting. We know the causes of post-transition suicidal ideation, and there really are only three. One is the loss of friends, family, job, church, synagogue. The second is the internalization of transphobia, that we take in the messages that are negative that come from the worlds we inhabit, which is particularly devastating to people coming from any one of the fundamentalist expressions of the desert religions. But the third is whether or not you pass in your new gender. And pass means that the world looks at you and doesn't see a transgender person, but assumes they're seeing a cisgender person. Virtually all, or let's say 99% of trans men, after a few years on testosterone, will pass in their new gender. It's less so for most trans women because testosterone makes permanent changes that can't be changed. So I'm almost 6'2", and to me it was, I thought it would not be possible to pass in my new gender. And the fact that I do makes life much, much easier for me than it is for a lot of other transgender people. I don't have to worry about traveling overseas. I don't have to worry about traveling in the South in rural areas that may not be supportive of trans folks, because unless people have seen me on television or one of my TED Talks, they have no idea who I am and no idea that I'm trans. So that was, in fact, the first surgery that I did. But I think it's important to be sensitive to that because that is a socioeconomic issue. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was a privileged white male. And so that was something that I was able to do that so many trans people are not able to do.
I was this line in your book, I wasn't born with a gold spoon, but access to spoons, I think is how you put it. You know, there's something I want to ask you about, Paula. In your darkest moments, you've sat and cried in an oversized chair, looking up and staring at clay pots. And I've been wondering, what are the clay pots and what is the symbolism? What do they mean to you?
Oh, my.
Take your time.
I'm staring at them right now.
Oh.
Oh, my. Kathy and I decorated this house together. And we always have had similar tastes, so it was very easy to do. But I never would have chosen the clay pots. There's a desert feel to them, and of course we live on the Front Range of Colorado, and it's high desert. But they were all chosen by her. So there is a part of her presence that remains in the room. And I think I take great comfort from that. I would never have chosen to end our marriage. We had an amazing, unbelievable marriage therapist. His last name was Solomon, which was perfect. And he retired, and we were his last clients on his last day. And we're both therapists. So I just asked him, I said, Mike, how many couples are willing to work this hard? And he didn't hesitate. He said 1%. And I said, how many couples get this far in working through their issues? And again, he didn't hesitate. He said 1%. And he said, which is what makes this so tragic, because you're a lesbian and Kathy is not. And I think that was the point at which we realized that our marriage would need to end, because we each needed to be true to who we were. But those pots are containers for me of the love that sustained us for 40 years. And I think I'm able to draw from them the strength in moments of darkness and loneliness, when the oppression of particularly that evangelical world I was once a part of, which has not been kind to me, when that comes down upon me, or when I think of the loss of a relationship that I dearly loved. Oh, that I have never been asked that. And oh, my goodness. Thank you.
Of course. Thank you. We only have about a minute left, but I would hope you could end for us on just what it feels like to you, for you to preach today and to minister and to be a counselor, and how that makes you feel.
I think we as humans are inherently spiritual beings, and I think it's best when we work out our spirituality in community. So I don't think it's nearly as important what we believe as it is that we work out, what does life mean? What is the basic meaning of life? And to work that out together, and to be given the honor to help a group of people in community figure out life together, that to me is wonderful. It's a wonderful task. It's a wonderful responsibility. And then to be able to do it as a therapist at a personal one-on-one level. I work from person-centered therapy, and the approach there is that you as a therapist don't have the answer to the person's questions. They have the answer to their own questions. Your job is to help them remove the obstacles that will enable them to get to those answers. And all of us want to remove the obstacles from living authentically.
Paula, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate, for having me with you. I really enjoyed it.
Paula Stone Williams, author of As a Woman, What I Learned About Power, Sex, and the Patriarchy After I Transitioned. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.